All right, let's take our Bibles and turn to Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. And tonight we'll be looking at the wisdom of Agur, part 3. So again, we'll be looking at part 3 of our study of the, if you will, standalone proverb by Agur, which is in Proverbs chapter 30. And specifically, we'll be looking at verses 21 through 33. So Proverbs 30, verse 21 through 33, which will take us to the end of the proverb. Now, in parts 1 and 2, if you recall, Agur indicated that there was this need for humility in order to obtain, but also to live out what I would call biblical wisdom, to differentiate between human wisdom or worldliness. Now, in part 3, Agur is going to conclude by doing a few things, one of which is showing just various topics, and these will either reflect humility or they will show the opposite of humility. So, in other words, the first two parts essentially show the need for humility. That is how we obtain wisdom. It also helps us in daily living to do that wisely, biblically. Whereas in part 3, we get several examples that will show us what biblical wisdom will produce if we yield to being humble versus not being humble. So let's start with a brief overview of the outline that we'll look at tonight. So the first thing we'll do is review both the handout, the introduction, as well as what we've covered in the first two parts. I'll just do a summary of those. But in terms of the biblical text, we'll first look at verses 21 through 23, the abuse or misuse of position. So here Agur is going to outline the normal order of things being, if you will, upside down. So there'll be that in verses 21 through 23, the abuse, misuse of position. And then in verses 24 through 28, we'll look at the wisdom of the small. So that's 24 through 28. Agur will point us to four small creatures, yet wise creatures. And we can learn as humans from these creatures. Of course, that presupposes humility. So that's 24 through 28. And then we'll look at verses 29 through 31, the majesty of the noble. Here, Agur will balance the smallness, the lessons, that is, that we can learn from small creatures in verses 24 through 28. He will, if you will, balance that out by pointing to some creatures that are walking in a stately or magisterial form. They'll be walking in nobility. So here, what we want to see is how someone who has nobility or a position of power doesn't necessarily mean that we can't learn from them. So this would be balancing out the four small creatures. And then finally, in verses 32 through 33, we'll have the final admonition or final piece of advice that Agur has. And it will show us once again the theme of humility, contrasting that with pride and anger. So we'll do a brief review, 21 through 23, the abuse, misuse of position, the wisdom of the small, 24 through 28, the majesty of the noble, 29 through 31, and then the final admonition or final piece of advice, 32 through 33. So if you have your handout, we're just going to do a brief review of that as well as the first two parts. So we'll start with the author. Of course, this is, as I've suggested, a standalone proverb versus what we typically think of, which is the book of Proverbs being primarily written by King Solomon. But here we don't know the author. There's a lot of speculation on his identity, meaning that of Agur's, but we just simply don't know because there's no other recordings of him in the Bible. And so we just would be left with conjecture, which I don't prefer doing. Some of that would be something along the lines of, well, some suggest that Agur is a pseudonym for Solomon, And the same would hold true for chapter 31. But I think it's just best to take it at face value. Agur is an unknown individual apart from what we have in verse 1 of chapter 30. Next, we have what is the theme? What is his overarching point? Well, as I have on the handout, I put it this way. Agur approached the Lord and his word with humility, recognizing the limits of human wisdom. He then turned to the Lord and his word to help him understand not only himself better, but the world in which he lived. So that's kind of our general theme, humility and the positive effects of it in our lives. So in terms of the text itself, we first looked at verses 1 through 4, the humility of the wise. A person needs to understand themselves before God. A proper view of ourselves will then produce humility. We will then, of course, also, I would suggest, have a better understanding of God. So said another way, the better we understand God and who He is, when we compare ourselves to God, that will naturally produce humility, or should. Then in verses 5 through 9, we saw how that this attitude of humility will enable us to both receive God's word, but also seek Him in prayer. Of course, we don't pray to God unless we are in need or have a need for that, and so humility is required in order to produce prayer in our lives often. And then we looked at verses 10 through 20, how humility is reflected. And it's reflected in such ways as not slandering others, avoiding a variety of evil practices, but most importantly, it's reflected in finding satisfaction in the Lord versus the things of this world. If, for instance, if you remember from chapter 30, of course, that's where we are. It says in verse 15, give, give. These are three things that will not be satisfied. Four that will not say enough. So the idea there is not being satisfied with earthly things, which of course points one to the Lord. So let's begin tonight as we look at this third and final part, verses 21 through 23. Agur will now provide a list of some more of these numerical proverbs. And he's going to start with four things that will cause trouble as well as be unbearable to those who are humble. So let's read verses 21 through 23. All right, thank you. So let's look at now verses 21 through 23. So now if you look at the handout, the extra one I gave, you'll notice this comes from Urban Jensen's Proverbs commentary from Moody. And Jensen has a brief, very concise explanation of the numerical proverbs, what they mean, why they're used, and he gives you a few examples. There's other places in Proverbs, such as Proverbs 6, where Solomon does the same approach. And so that's a helpful explanation. You'll see where Jensen gives you regarding Agur, how he uses the idea of fours, for this, for that, and so forth. And so you can look at that and see the explanation as well as the examples that he gives of the fours, one of which is what we're looking at right here in verses 21 through 23. Now, Jensen titles it slightly different, but the same idea, the abuse or misuse of position. These are four things in 21 through 23 that reflect this general principle, and I'll point it out to you in a moment, but let's look at the list of four. So in this list of four, we see the first one is a servant unprepared for ruling. So this would be, again, the idea of people in a place of position or that either abuse or misuse the position. It just shows a dysfunctional order of things, the natural order of things not being upheld, perhaps another way to say it. So you can imagine someone who is unqualified, is not prepared, not ready, and they go into a position of leadership. Of course, they can cause a lot of trouble. There's one thing to say a learning curve, but when you put someone in a position that just simply doesn't need to be there, it's extremely problematic and definitely upside down from the normal order of things. You want someone who's prepared to rule. Two, the next list of the four, two, a fool full of food. Someone who's full of food in this example, a couple of things you could draw from that, but one being someone who would then become insensitive towards the need of others. So again, someone who is a fool, who has a fullness, they're not going to, of course, see the need for other people to have their needs met. Three, this one, a little bit of clarification, the idea of unloved means a hated woman. So you have a hated woman, and eventually she marries, and the probability is strife and problems within the marriage. Then four, we have a handmaid who displaces her mistress. The idea there is essentially that outside of the normal household order, this would create a lot of turmoil. You bring in another handmaid, another mistress, a wife, if you will, into the occasion. What you end up with is turmoil in the household. So this would be an example of Genesis 16:5, Genesis 16 in particular, with Hagar. Anytime you have two women involved, and one of which is married, or you have, in some cases in the Bible, two women who are married to the same man, of course, it causes a lot of turmoil. So again, all of this is to basically point out and picture a person who is either in a place of or takes advantage of their position. And so it's outside the normal working of what God has planned for his people. And these people, none of which would be showing humility. So when people either misuse or are placed in positions they're unprepared for, of course they cause a lot of damage. And the only countermeasure to all four of these examples would be humility. Someone who is humble, that serves, of course, is open to correction, but is looking for the Lord to produce and to lead them, and so forth. All right, next, moving on, we see verses 24 through 28, the wisdom of the small. This one's a pretty straightforward one, and we also see a comparable illustration that Paul uses. So in these verses, Agur reflects that the Lord often works through seemingly weak things to triumph over the seemingly strong things. So this would be the idea that where we have a humble person who will be willing to look at small creatures, because God works through, if you will, small things. He works through inferior or weak things, as we'll see in a few moments. So let's look at another series of four. So this is another numerical structure here, verses 24 through 28. Four small yet wise creatures. The first are ants. Now, one may look at this and think, well, what could we learn from ants? Well, Agur says that ants prepare for the future. Of course, a humble person could look at this and say, I have much to learn from an ant because I too need to prepare for the future. Of course, the future is in the Lord's hands, but at the same time, he wants us to be good stewards as well and prepare as much as is possible. Of course, ultimately depending on him, but nevertheless. So the first one is ants. The next one in the NESB 95, which I use, uses a interesting word there. You'll notice it's S-H-E-P-H-A-N-I-M. This would be another word for a badger, and these badgers seek refuge in rocks. They're wise. They seek refuge in something that is safe and secure. This would be somewhat comparable to the fact that God is a refuge for his people. He is a rock to his people, and badgers do the same thing. So you have four yet small yet wise creatures: ants, badgers. The next one are locusts. Now this one's a curious one, because in verse 27 it says the locusts have no king, yet all of them go in ranks. In other words, there is order, there is unity, and they don't have to have a, if you will, leader present. in order for there to be unity. Now imagine, I say this a little bit humorously, imagine a church with no leadership. Well, would we all function and would the church function in unity? Well, I would hope so, but the probability is probably not always that high, but that's something we could learn from Locust, which is when the leader's not around, there's still unity. There's still this common goal and ability to work with others. Of course, that requires humility. If you think of Philippians chapter 4, you know that Paul had some issues there in Philippi with Euodia and Syntyche, and much of that was with the lack of humility. Humility will solve a lot of problems in a church, and humility will eventually produce, of course, unity. So that's three of the four small yet wise creatures: ants, badgers, locusts. But then the last one being, in most translations, verse 28, speak of a lizard. But if you were to have the King James, it actually uses the translates it as a spider. But you'll notice it says that they are, even though you may grasp them with your hands, yet they are in kings' palaces. So they're in prominent places. They're everywhere. And they're in places that you might not expect. So ants, badgers, locusts, and lizards, i.e. spiders, whatever the case is. The idea there being that a humble person can learn from these creatures. They have value. Of course, God's created them, and so we should expect that. Alan Ross, in his commentary, writes, "In God's reaction, wisdom manifests itself in a variety of ways. And humans can learn the value of wisdom over size and numerical strength." Now, if you don't follow what Ross is saying there, what he's essentially saying is the Lord works through weak things to point people to the true source of power, which is the Lord. And we see this often in the church. Whether it be someone who maybe is not naturally a speaker, God enables them to do so. Maybe it's just a variety of other things. God empowers his people through the Spirit, through the indwelling of the Spirit. He also gifts them to do things they can't on their own. And so that's the general idea there, is that God works through weak things. And he oftentimes uses weak things to shame the strong, as Paul would say. For example, Paul likes to use this kind of idea there that God doesn't always use what we might think. Notice 1 Corinthians 1:27, "But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong." All right, so having now looked at two of the four items that we're going to look at as we conclude our study, we've looked at the abuse, misuse of position, 21 through 23, the wisdom of the small, 24 through 28. Now we move on to verses 29 through 30. Now, Agur will contrast the lowly creatures that we just looked at to ones of more noble or greater stature in terms of creatures. So let's look at verses 29 through 31, and after we read these, then we'll look at these particular creatures. Again, these would be on the other end of the spectrum. So again, you have more numerical proverbs here in 29 through 31. There are three things, and then you'll notice in the corresponding portion of the verse, it says even four. So again, you have the fours. As again, Agur's prominent way of doing much of the proverb is through these numerical proverbs, four things, four things, four things. His way of communicating these truths to us. But here, when we look at these, you're going to see these are, of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum. What are these things? Well, notice the lion, which is mighty among beasts and does not retreat before any, the strutting rooster, the male goat, and a king. Of course, the king being, I would assume here, the more of the prominent ones. So that's the three and then the four. So the fourth being the prominent one in the poetry, if you will. So you have the lion, the strutting rooster, the goat, and the king. All of these would be people or creatures that are in a noble or stately manner. That's the way in which they live. And so this would, of course, be the opposite of the weak, small things. So it's creating what I would call a balanced approach. A lot of times we would sit there and think, okay, so God only works through small, insignificant people and insignificant positions or places. Well, that's not always true. Is it true? Yes. Is it always true? And the answer would be no. Sometimes God works through people that are in places of prominent authority. Maybe it's a person who is in a high role or position somewhere, and God does use them. We can also, if we have humility, learn from them just as we can from people in a lower position. Thomas Constable puts it this way, verses 29 through 31, Constable writes, "Now these stately things demonstrate that a proper bearing in life comes neither from exalting nor depreciating oneself. It comes from functioning as God created one to function." His point there, Constable is saying, is just as the ant is functioning in his place where God has put him, in like manner, so does the lion. The lion functions the way that God has intended for him to function. He doesn't work outside of that. He doesn't go outside of the mold which God's given him. He functions within that role. And so that's the idea there. It produces a balance, we might say. Constable also points out three general principles. He says that we can derive from these verses. First, each of us is put in a certain place and should be confident where God has placed them. So again, each of us, if we think of from the New Testament, each of us has been gifted with a specific gift, a specific calling. We might could use that a little bit loosely there. But the point is, God has a particular place for each of us within the body of Christ. We need to find that place and function in that place, being secure and confident there. I certainly don't want to demean ourselves. Two, Constable says, in terms of a principle, he says, two, our confidence should not be in our position, but in the Lord who placed us there. I think that's an important lesson because, again, a true servant serves where God has placed them. They don't choose it for themselves. This can go back to some of our previous lessons in these verses. For instance, we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we don't need to be or shouldn't be or not ready for. That would be definitely not the best thing to do. However, when we know where God's placed us, we can be confident, but we also can know that it's God who puts us there. And so he gets the praise for it. And then third, Constable says we need to be careful about strutting in pride because of our position. So what Constable says there is the flip side, which is, again, God places us, we don't place ourselves, if done appropriately and biblically, and in like manner, we can then make sure that we aren't prideful because we know that the Lord's placed us wherever that may be. All right, so now we've looked at three of the four sections here in this proverb of Agur, and again, these come sort of rapid fire, and we've looked at the first three of four, so now we're going to move into the fourth and final for our study tonight, but also this is the final admonition, verses 32 through 33. This is Agur's final bit of advice, as again, we don't have any other further writings from Agur, but this final admonition or final bit of advice that Agur provides, again, it points to the key theme, I think, which is in the chapter, which is humility. Here, what Agur's going to do is he's going to show that pride and anger are contrasted with humility. So in other words, a humble person will be able to keep their pride and anger in check when it comes, and he gives us exhortations on how that happens. So let's look at verses 32 through 33 as we finish out this study of Agur's proverb, and I will just read this one for us. It's 32 through 33. "If you have been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have plotted evil, put your hand on your mouth. verse 33, for the churning of milk produces butter, and the pressing the nose brings forth blood. So the churning of anger produces strife. And so those with that concludes Agur's proverb. But let's look at these verses. You'll notice if you have. So it's somewhat assuming that you probably all have done this. But he says in the past tense, if you have, notice, do what? Well, in this case, it is, of course, exalting yourself or have plotted evil. So this is something that an individual has done for themselves or to themselves or perhaps plotted against someone else, someone who has exalted themselves. Man exalts himself a lot of times. I think sometimes he does it unknowingly, but oftentimes he does pridefully. He exalts himself, and instead of doing that, he needs to take the antidote, and the antidote is to take, as I might put it this way, the pill of humility. Because humility will keep us from exalting ourselves. If we go back to the beginning of the proverb, if we have a proper view of ourselves in front of God, we wouldn't exalt ourselves. We would realize who we truly are. He also says, of course, if you've plotted evil, if you've done things that are evil, and we probably all have probably done some of this to varied extents, but you'll notice the exhortation, put your hand over your mouth. It's, in other words, it's an exhortation just simply to stop. So if you've been exalting yourself, you need to stop. And the way you would do that is to stop speaking of yourself in such a, if you will, lofty way. If you've been plotting evil, you need to stop speaking because that's where it's coming from. But then lastly, you come to the word, and you'll notice if you have in your Bibles laid out, since this is poetry, you'll see where it says, for the churning, and then the last verse, so the churning, which begs the question, what's the word churning mean? Well, churning, or you think of twisting, means to press something. And so what he's saying is, don't stir up these things. Don't be someone who stirs up things, because there's enough, if you will, problems in life. We don't need to stir things up. We don't need to churn up, if you will, and stir up anger, which is the ending there, because all that's going to produce is strife and problems. The Ryrie Study Bible puts it this way. It says, one tempted to anger must exercise self-restraint in light of these certain results, which is nothing good. Nothing good will come from that. It makes me think of James, where James writes and says that the anger of man doesn't produce God's righteousness. It just doesn't have the ability to do so. So what we would see as he concludes here is that it's a very simple point here, which is a desire for peaceful behavior will be seen in, of course, again, humility. So it's a sign of humility is a desire for peacefulness. We won't want to exalt ourselves. We won't want to stir up problems, evil, and we won't also want to produce anger. We'll want to quell the anger in us. So as we conclude Proverbs 30, this standalone proverb of Agur, he teaches us the need for humility in order to live a wise life. If we don't have humility, we won't be able to receive God's instruction, we won't seek him in prayer, and then of course we won't be open to living out some of these principles, because sometimes God's word's going to sting us, it's going to correct us, to try to put us back on the right path. But if there's no humility, then we won't receive it. And so then it's just a never-ending stream of problems. So as we look at this and we finish, we see that there's just a simple need to have humility in our lives. I'm going to close with this. It's an anonymous poem, but it reflects this basic truth. It's called Teach Me to Bow. And so the poem reads, teach me to bow, O gracious Lord, where self grows dim and Christ adorned, to walk unseen, to serve unheard, content to trust thy word. Break pride's hard grip upon my heart, lest from simple faith I depart. Let lowly paths my joy afford, for there I walk the steps of Christ, my Lord.